Hello, it is Ryan, and we could all use an extra bright spot in our day, couldn't we? Just to make up for things like sitting in traffic, doing the dishes, counting your steps, you know, all the mundane stuff. That is why I'm such a big fan of Chumba Casino. Chumba Casino has all your favorite social casino-style games that you can play for free anytime, anywhere with daily bonuses. That should brighten your day a little. Actually, a lot. So sign up now at chumbacasino.com. That's ChumbaCasino.com. No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.
Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome. Welcome to the Chauncey Show, where we're always right and never left. We put God first and politics second. Welcome to the show. With everything going on in our country and the world today, there is not a conversation that is important than our democracy. Today we have poet, a writer, in the studio. Richard Lyons is the author of The DNA of Democracy in the Shadows of the Apocalypse. He is going to take us an inside look on how democracy began and where we are today and where we are headed. Let me welcome into the studio without any further ado, writer and author Richard Lyons. Hey, Rich.
Hello, Chauncey. Thanks for the great introduction. That was very kind.
Thank you very much. Thank you for taking time out of your busy schedule to come on the show and talk to my listeners about the DNA of democracy. If you want to talk a little bit about yourself first, we can do that. Or, you know, I'm excited just to jump right in and talk about the history of democracy. We have about an hour, so we have a lot of time to talk. So I'll let you
okay.
Take it away.
Well, my background is Middle Western. I grew up in the Chicago area, and I grew up in a family that was in printing. My grandfather started a printing company called Argus Press 100 years ago, right now. And then my father expanded that into educational publishing. So that involved developmental learning materials, which was special education for kids, and then Argus Communications, which was education of a religious basis. And so I grew up in that field, and I was on the printing presses. I was selling printing. I worked in the shipping department all over the printing company, and then in the publishing companies. And just formed. I've always loved literature. So it took me into when we sold a large part of our company, and my brother bought the printing company. I decided to start writing and become an indie publisher, so that I could write what I wanted. And hopefully for the good of the public. So I wrote a few books now, and The DNA of Democracy, getting right to your point, is a history of the infrequent instances where democracy has succeeded in history. For most of human experience, mankind has lived in what I call the common keep. The common keep is one of tyranny, where you have a pharaoh or a king or an emperor and a few of his cohorts or police or army. And the multitudes are those who get to do what they were told. So our form of democracy was born of, to go back to the beginning, the Ten Commandments. The reason the Ten Commandments were remarkable is because right across the Sinai Desert, there was the Pharaoh, Ramses, and he was God on earth to the Egyptians. The difference with Judaic tradition is that God takes the form of law on earth. It doesn't take the form of a person. So when things are based on law, even the Pharaoh is subject to law, right? So that was a key difference in human history. I then go from that experience, you know, where God was the Pharaoh on earth to law being God on earth, to the Greeks, where, and in Greece, this will sound familiar, but there was a king called Isagoras, and he claimed that half the Athenians, half of the entire population, were cursed. And because they were spiritually cursed, they could be dispossessed of their property and exiled from Athens. So when you hear today of the MAGA people being cursed, or half the country is beneath the other half the country, it has a reflection in Greece. And so the people of Athens overtook their own government and overcame Isagoras and a mercenary Spartan army that had never been defeated before. And on the Acropolis, they defeated that army and created their own government based on a constitution. That constitution gave every citizen a vote. That gave every citizen certain rights. And so that was without example in human history prior to then. I then go to Rome, where another king was overthrown. Tarquinius Superbus was his name. And he was overthrown because he was acting in a wrathful, tyrannic manner and overtook the kingship without the right to do so. And so a man named Brutus expelled Tarquin from the throne and set up and sacrificed his life and those of his sons to set up what is called the 12 tables. That is the common law of Rome, from which we derive some of our common law today. So that is the ancient experience, the classical experience, and I walk through that for a very good reason, because all these elements later in the work are involved in our creation, the creation of America. And I don't think people really understand that, how infrequent democracy is, how fragile it is, and how every element we were founded with in our Constitution is really critical. So I'm hoping to get that across. So that takes us through the classical period, and I don't know whether you would have a question at that point.
To be honest with you, Rich, I'm really excited about listening to this history, and I don't want to throw you off your game plan. But I think it's important what you're sharing. If I had to think about questions, it would be more to the latter, because how did we get to where we are today?
Okay. Well, let me get a little further through the DNA of democracy.
Exactly.
Then.
Exactly.
And then,
yeah.
And then we'll,
I would appreciate
we'll open it up.
That. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Okay.
That'll be better. So then my listeners have a content.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So we've gone through the importance of law from the Ten Commandments, the importance of a constitution with Athens, the importance of common law and property rights, very important, from the Romans. And that concluded the classical era, because after that there was 1,000 years of darkness. There were no democracies. There were a few scattered republics in the north of Italy. But otherwise, again, the common keep was the home of humanity. But then in England, it happened that in 1200, after William the Conqueror overtook England, and this is very interesting, he created a castle system. If you go to England now, Chauncey, you will see these magnificent Norman castles that have literally been there now for 1,000 years. And the reason was that when William conquered England, he had his nobles create castles, build castles, each one not one day's ride from the other, so that they could form a mutual defense system across the whole of England. And they called it the bones of the kingdom, or tying down the countryside. But they were the fortresses of kings and their nobles. And it was to hold people out of the place of power. It was also to imprison them within the place of power if they were rebellious. Well, it came that William had a descendant called King John, and there's a reason that there has not been a King John since the first King John. He was really a horrible tyrant and the son of Henry II, who was a great king, and so he was followed by John, who was a terrible king. John wanted to maintain his overlordship of France, and to do so, he had the practice of imprisoning nobles, the sons of nobles, as a ransom for loyalty. And so he had at one point some 200, over 200 nobles in his care after there was a rebellion in France. And he allowed all of these prisoners to die by starvation, so that all the nobles who were supposed to be loyal became outraged by this. And when John's armies went to take a former friend's sons, his name was Henry de Broise, and his wife was named Matilda. When John went to take their sons into custody as a ransom for loyalty, Matilda was alone. Henry was in France. And Matilda said, "No, you're not taking my sons anywhere because we know exactly what happens to your prisoners." So John's army had to back up because Matilda was very strong, in a strong military position. And so, but she had to run because thereafter John brought his whole horde of an army to take her castle and her. She ran off with herself, her son William, their kids, his son William's kids, and his wife, and led a trajectory. First they went to Ireland to outrun him. Then they went to the Isle of Man to outrun him. Then they were found and captured in Scotland, I think in Carrickfergus. When they were taken down to Windsor Castle, the place where the coronation just happened, right? They were taken there, and they were put in a dungeon that they used to call an oblique. They call it that because it's shaped like a jar, and the ceiling curves over your head so you can't climb up any wall. And they call it an oubliette because that's French for a place to be forgotten. They put Matilda and her son and her son's wife and children in the oubliette, and they were found 2 weeks later dead. This so outraged the remaining nobles in the country that they came together in a rebellion, and that rebellion ended up being the Magna Carta. The signing of the Magna Carta is one of the principal documents in the history of democratic rule in the world, signed in 1215. And it is a cornerstone of our common law. It protects rights to property. It protects individual rights. It is the foundation of habeas corpus and the trial method. All these things were won with the Magna Carta. And so that was, I juxtapose these things throughout the book. So in Athens, for instance, you have Isagoras and then you have Cleisthenes. He was the rebel who was the founder of the democratic government. In Rome, you have Tarquinius and you have Brutus. In England, you have King John and you have Matilda. And then John Langton, who was the Archbishop of Canterbury, who actually wrote the Magna Carta. So then I go from there and to the deeper into British history, because that's more our own history based on government. Mm-hmm. And I go into the divine right time of Henry VIII and how he assumed to himself, and you'll appreciate this, Chauncey, King Henry assumed to himself the spiritual authority. So what is that doing?
Mm-hmm.
He led, as he said it, ruled, he said, by divine right. Where does that bring us back to? It brings us back to the pharaohs being God on mm-hmm. earth. Henry thought he was God on earth and that
yes.
everything should bend to his will, forgetting the better laws of God. So that ended up creating another revolution, and that one being in England, and that was the Civil War in England. And a curious thing happened during that time. Different power centers took power. So that originally, the king that was executed, who maintained his divine right to rule, was Charles I. When he was overcome, it was the parliament that became superior. Yes? So the crown was down, parliament became superior, but then they started to rule tyrannically through a rump parliament. So they became as bad as the king had been before. Then the army took over and created their own sort of a dictatorship under Oliver Cromwell. So I call that section of the book The Lords of the Hour. Why? Because it's a common trait in humankind to want power. Once you have power, you want to expand power. And once you expand power, you want to defend power and never give it up. It's a common trait we all share, and that is why we need, you know, democratic government, in fact. So after the Lords of the Hour, many of the exiles from England came over as pilgrims out of that crucible in England, out of the tyranny both of Charles I and then the tyranny exercised against persons of religion by Charles II when he was restored to power. When they got over to America, now this, we're moving into the American section of the DNA of democracy. America was utterly unique. The persons that were on this continent at the time, well, the ones that the settlers met, were either of the Iroquois Confederation or they were of the Cherokee, five civilized tribes. Both of these associations were federations of tribes that believed in the same thing, the absolute freedom of their tribes. They fashioned their governments to govern least while keeping, you know, a common defense. So it was something that the settlers had never known before, having come from England. And when they got into an area which was a wilderness to build a civilization out of, they literally grew their government out of the ground. The first part of government was the family. The second part of the government was your associations, whether it's a religious association, educational association, or the town government. So everybody was learning how to self-govern in America. That was not a practice in England beforehand. It had never been. So they were, and they, I call it government grown out of the ground, because just as they grew their crops, they grew their idea of government. And even the religious aspects of their lives was based on freedom. Congregants voted for their pastors. Pastors weren't assigned as they had been in England.
Mm-hmm.
The mayor was elected. The mayor wasn't appointed by a king. So it's a very different kind of government growing up. It's a government literally of everybody, right? So, and that it's unique to America, that sort of upbringing, and having the space to create new ideas of government throughout the colonies. So then we get to a crucible, because a couple of hundred years go by, and then happened the French and Indian War in the 1750s. Mm-hmm. We call it the French and Indian War in America. It's called the War of the Austrian Succession, or the Seven Years' War in Europe. And it was a global conflict. In America, it bankrupted England in maintaining her colonies. She won the war, but at great expense. And so after the war, having done so much to own America, the English Parliament became a tyrant. They started demanding taxes of the colonials, and also demanding taxes far in excess of what had been taxed before. They were using the taxes to have standing armies in the colonies and policemen and spies. In other words, the colonials saw all around them that they were paying for their own oppression. This is very important. Taxes paying for oppression. And that is how you create a common keep. And so the colonials, after having 200 years of self-rule in 13 colonies, right, they had been left alone until the French and Indian Wars. They had literally been left alone to govern themselves. So the king all of a sudden got irate. What do you mean they aren't going to pay taxes? And the parliament became irate. What do you mean they're not going to follow our laws? Well, from the colonies, the colonists were saying, we are not represented in your parliament, and our taxes are not spent on what we would spend them on. And without, you know, we demand representation if we're going to be taxed, not oppression. And that was the whole point of the Revolutionary War. A distant capital was dictating the laws and terms of governance in America, where Americans had been free for a couple of centuries. So that became, you know, a crucible again, a crucible between a tyranny and a country desiring to be free. And I go into a great explanation of it in the DNA of Democracy, not to tire your readers, but I do it in a narrative form so that it's storytelling. And it's not about hard dates and all that. It's storytelling. It's about heroes.
Yes.
Heroes. And the thing I found, Chauncey, in the Revolutionary War, literally everybody took part. The entire colonial population that wasn't married to England, literally, decided that their common liberty, which you can't put a price on, right? It's not something you buy and sell. Their common liberty was more important than their life. Their common liberty was more important than their property. Their common liberty was more important than their business or their wealth. It was an amazing sacrifice to make to create the country that was created here. And so I go from that great great sacrifice and great creation of a country to a point where the colonists were all saying, okay, we just won the war. What does it mean? You know what I mean? We've just won. We've thrown out the most powerful army and navy on earth, and we just whipped them off the continent and out of our harbors. So what do we do with it? Well, a lot of colonists wanted a very loose arrangement based on the Articles of Confederation so that the states were supreme and there wouldn't be a federal government. There would just be Articles of Mutual Defense sort of structure. Others wanted a federal government that was more concentrated, and that would be in the vein of Alexander Hamilton. So there came a convention of the new states. 12 states were represented there. Rhode Island decided to abstain. From the 12 states, there were 55 representatives. Now, these are all persons practiced in self-government. And why would that be? Well, because they held office in the colonial structure of government, or they ran their towns, or they were generals in the army, or lieutenants, or what have you. All of them were brought up in the art of self-governance, and they also brought into Philadelphia all their libraries, every book they had, based on types of government, types of constitutions, how other societies went wrong. What happened to Athens? Why was that? Why did that go wrong? Well, because in a pure democracy, mob rule becomes tyranny because a mob takes over based on a demagogue.
Amen.
So they studied all these things and came up with the Constitution, which is a document that diffuses power. And I'll try and explain as America was brought up from the ground up.
Richard, if it's okay, before you continue, just let me do a little quick break.
Sure.
For those that are tuning in, we're listening to Richard Lyons, author, writer, architect of the DNA of Democracy, breaking down the history of tyranny and democracy in its current state. We thank you very much for having him in the studio. Rich, you are giving us a ton of information, and as I'm listening to you, I'm able to consume it in one time, and I'm really enjoying it. And before you continue, the information that you're sharing is so important that I'd like to break this stuff down in segments, and I'd like to have you back on, because even though the summaries of today, different segments, people have no idea on how we got to where we are today. You know, most people just know about the Roman history to the United States. But how you break down the DNA is critical for our understanding of not only where we are today, and you mentioned before I went to a quick break about tyranny, how democracy today is overthrowing the current republic of our nation. So it's very interesting where we are in American history. I consider myself a constitutionalist conservative. And yes, you know, the Constitution was put there as a stopgap, if you will, to restrain government and the will of politicians in government. But we see we have that challenge today. So I'll let you continue, but I'm excited to have you on. This information is awesome. And like I said, I hope that I can have you on doing a series where we could really educate, you know, the public on where we are, how we got here, and where we're going, and what we should do or what we can do to help maybe change or make the direction better.
Well, you know that it's all important, I think, Chauncey, that people are educated. It's the basis of having a properly ordained government of the people. If the people don't understand why the government is the way it is, it's hard to know how to vote. Other than people mostly vote today, oh, I'm a Democrat. Oh, I'm a Republican. They don't think about what it means as much as I think an education in this sort of thing is a matter of self-help. So at any rate, we got to the point where we were at the Constitutional Convention in Philadelphia in 1787. And government again was brought from the ground up. The first thing conceived by the framers of the Constitution was, how do we get a federal government to leave proper government alone? And when they thought about proper government, they were thinking about the town halls in Massachusetts. They were thinking about assemblies in Pennsylvania. They were thinking about county government in the South. How do we keep the federal government out of people's lives? It wasn't a matter of how can the government help. It was how can you keep it away, right? You're supposed to frame your own life in the way you would design it. And that doesn't happen when you have an involved government. So they based local government on, okay, what will the federal government not do? So in the Bill of Rights, that's all about individual rights and trials and defense from government. But there's also the Ninth and Tenth Amendments and the Fifth Amendment, which tries to protect the rights of individuals and their towns and states by saying by saying those powers not enumerated in the Constitution are those reserved to the citizens and the states of America. So what is that? That is the individual, that is the town the individual lives in. That's the business of the individual, right, in the enterprise system. And that's the state. It was conceived that the states would be a bulwark of defense from an overreaching federal government. And so that's why, so at the local level, it's framed like an Athenian democracy where everybody has a vote, everybody has input. When the populations become greater, they become republics. So we have, in fact, today, 50 republics. Each of the states is a republic unto itself. The framers thought most law, most things to affect most individuals would occur at the town level. The next place at which law would affect the individual is at the state level. The place where law would affect the individual least would be laws derived from the federal government, right? That was the most distant government creation, and they confined it with the Constitution, saying you can only do what the Constitution says. Every other power is reserved to individuals, towns, and states. So we'll get to how that was overrun recently. But so coming out of the convention, we had a constitution agreed to and ratified by 10 of the 13 states, and it functioned well. There was, however, a compromise in the constitution. We all know what it was, and it was the matter of slavery. The only way to get the southern states to agree to come together in a union was to have an allowance of slavery in the South while sunsetting the slave trade 20 years to the day after the signing of the Constitution. So this compromise was a compromise that the whole country had to pay for, 80 years later, in the form of the Civil War, when in order to fuse a line from the Declaration of Independence into the Constitution that all men are created equal, one half of the country went to war with the other half of the country at the cost of over 1 million casualties and a burning down of the South and all of its economic interests and half the population. In order to fuse that line into the Constitution in the 13th, 14th, and 15th Amendments. What is that? What does that prove? What it proves is that our Constitution came a long way to being cured through the Civil War. It was a crucible that, you know, bled the country dry. But it came to the effect of Abraham Lincoln, his inspiration and his design was after the war, through the constitutional method of amendment, through the 13th, 14th, and 15th Amendments, to expand the franchise to include all persons equally in the country. So the DNA of democracy then goes into the suffragette movement. And why is that important? The women's movement from 1900 gained its popularity through parades and through education, literally what we're doing right now, Chauncey, talking to people and getting the word out. Why do women not have an equal vote? And, of course, nobody could come up with a good reason.
Right.
Because women in America, uniquely, women in America were educated, and some were far better educated than their husbands. So,
yes.
And that it became a movement, and it was done the right way. It was done through the amendment process, and two-thirds of the House and Senate approved it as an amendment. It went out for ratification, and two-thirds of the states approved the amendments. And so we have the 19th Amendment, which is the suffragette movement. So that ends the DNA of democracy, and there's a reason why. I don't know if you have a question now. If you do, that's all the evolution and all the parts that are important to how our country was founded and became at its best, the most country with the widest enfranchisement and the greatest diffusion of power between local, state, and federal government, was right at that time.
Very insightful. A lot of history, a lot of knowledge. Questions. I mean, you've given us so much information. The first thing I think about if I think about a question, is since the beginning of democracy, how has it changed? How do I want to frame my question?
Well, you had the Greek model, which was
right.
Wrong in that it gave a vote to everybody, and a demagogue can run through can become the catalyst of a mob who will take rights away from their fellow citizens. Right? In Rome,
right.
the case was that there were two brothers called the Gracchi. They were Tiberius, and I can't remember the Gaius Gracchus.
Mm-hmm.
They
mm-hmm.
empowered the tribuneship at the cost of the Senate. The Senate had been that vessel between the patrician class and the plebeian class that melded all the representations into one place to arrive at a law that it was a peaceful way of coming to a common law. The Gracchi overempowered the tribuneship and so overpowered the mob. When that happened, there was a slow
mm-hmm.
descent into the sort of empire that Rome became. You had Marius, then
right.
Sulla, and those were preceding to Caesar, right? And we know what happened with him. And then the long
mm-hmm.
catalog of emperors, but the Republic died right there. That's when the Republic died with the accession of Julius Caesar. So yeah, so
exactly.
our government, Chauncey, was one that took all these factors into effect and put it in
okay.
the Constitution to guard us from the mob. How do you do that? You create a House of Representatives that represents the people directly. Then you have a Senate that represents the people and their states, right? So if you are the senator from Missouri, you represent all the people of Missouri and you represent your state in order to be a defense against federal overreach. We have lost that, and it's part of the next book. So when we move from the DNA of democracy to the shadows of the Acropolis, we are now in the 1900. One of our favorite presidents was Teddy Roosevelt. He was one of the most unique American characters in our history. But he also grew up at a time when he was a kid. Italy, which had been a series of unorganized principalities, became a unified country. And Germany, again, a series of ununified principalities, became a country because they formed a federal system based on a sort of a strongman character. Teddy Roosevelt grew up with that, and he wanted to have a stronger federal government and a stronger executive office. And that's where the problem starts in America. And one thing that he did, I go back in Shadows of the Acropolis and I juxtapose founders to those who did not carry on in their tradition. So in the first part of the book, I call it Dinner at Jefferson's. And why do I do that? Because Tom Jefferson had dinner with Madison and with Alexander Hamilton. And there were two things on the plate. One was, how do we consolidate the war debts of the states into a central bank, because everybody was suspicious of a central anything. And the second thing was, what about a capital? Where's it going to be? So they came to the conclusion that the capital should not be more than 10 by 10 miles square. It should not possess any property. It should not possess any power by weight of the land that was under it. So it could not be part of a state, because that would make the state powerful. It had to be on its own. It had to be 10 by 10 square feet and no more. So I juxtapose that to what Ted Roosevelt did, and he assumed lands in 31 states. We had 31 states at the time. And he assumed lands, calling them park lands and natural forests and this sort of thing, but it consolidated under the federal government and the executive branch all those lands. So immediately the executive office of our government became the chief landholder in the country, much like a monarch in Britain, much like William I. Chauncey, I'm hearing a little background. Is there a machine running?
Yes, it's my air purifier. That's what you're hearing.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, I apologize. Yeah, I said, I wonder if you could hear my air purifier. Yeah, I apologize.
So that consolidated a great amount of power in the executive office right there just by doing that. It gave the federal government land in states that it was never conceived of as being something that would ever happen in America based on the Constitution, because in the Constitution, the capital was consigned 10 by 10 square miles of area. So then we go to Woodrow Wilson. Woodrow Wilson was a devotee. Well, first, to state what a lot of people don't know, he grew up on college campuses. He was a professor. His life was surrounded by the manicured lawns of the Ivy League universities. Now, our form of government from the Constitution is based on the philosophy of John Locke. John Locke based our Constitution. Our Constitution was based on his philosophy of the individual, that God grants rights to individuals, and those individuals always have those rights. Individuals decide what the government can and can't do. The citizen is the ruler. The government is the servant. It's the inverse of the common keep, exact inverse. Well, along came Woodrow Wilson, and he was fascinated by Germany. He was fascinated by Frederick the Great. He was fascinated by a philosopher called Friedrich Hegel. Friedrich Hegel, his philosophy was based on the ideal state, and it's called ideal state theory in Germany. And it's based on administrative ministerial law. And if you want to see what that looks like, it's what the EU is today. And it is what our government is becoming. It is the growth of an administrative state under government that makes its own rules. There's supposed to be congressional oversight. I don't know how much that happens nowadays.
Right.
But they make their own rules and they enforce them. That is the quotient for tyranny, as described by those who fought the British Empire. At any rate, he created the administrative state, and from that time, exactly 100 years ago, this administrative state has been growing, and it's been growing through what we call the agencies. So what is it? It's the Food and Drug Administration. It's the EPA, right? And it's also the law enforcement agency. So it's the FBI. It's the CIA. It's the IRS, right? It's all these agencies who are creating massive amounts of law and are unanswerable to any of the people's representatives, right?
Yes.
They're supposed to be ideally answerable to representatives in Congress and the Senate. They are less and less answerable by the day in that the Democrats are now, they use the administrative state to promote their policies that they can't get passed in Congress. So they pass amorphous laws and say to the FDA, enforce those laws, or say to the SEC, enforce those laws by making up rules to fit the law that we think this should be. So I'll give you an example. During the Obama presidency, that's 8 years of presidency, there were 400 or so laws passed through the people's representatives, right? That's called the original fountain of authority by Alexander Hamilton. Only 400 or so laws passed through the houses of Congress and were signed into law. Over 20,000 rules with the effect of law and with the enforcement of law enforcement agencies were passed through agencies of the federal government. There are now some 440 agencies unanswerable to anybody because the Democrats defend the agencies, because that is where they make policy. So we are in a country now that had power removed from local authority, removed from state authority, bounded into the federal government, and in the federal government into the executive branch. And it has been a career that's been 100 years long now, and now we're seeing the effects now. Donald Trump, as brusque as he is and as much as he bothers people and his personality can be grating, he was a greater threat to the Democrats because of his policies. He dared to say, some of these regulations should be ended. We shouldn't have this much regulation. Some of these taxes should not be had. We ought to reduce the taxation on the American people, and we ought to empower the states. We ought to have freedom of education. And these are things that when a Democrat hears it, or persons in the administrative state, that's their power base. And so he's a big threat to them. So we can go now. I've talked about a little bit Woodrow Wilson. I should get to FDR. I didn't mean to jump ahead like that. But there's more
because we have about 10 more minutes left. But
okay.
You can go ahead, because I'm enjoying the conversation. I'm sure my listeners are too. I do want to do a little.
Okay.
You got me excited. When I was in college.
FDR.
When I was.
That's when you were in college. Sorry.
When I was in college, it's about John Locke. My first philosophy class, I asked the question, how does one acquire rights? That was my introduction to John Locke
in
philosophy.
That's a great question.
It was awesome. Well, yeah, I mean, you know.
But that,
so
Chauncey, I
got
to stop you. Chauncey, I have to stop you right there, because that's what this entire book is about. Where do we derive rights? In John Locke's philosophy, the individual is the ruler and the government is the servant, because rights are derived from God. that single source. God is not Pharaoh. God is a God of law, and God bestowed rights on each individual. The way the government is going in this administrative state, the ideal state theory, to try and be simple about it, it means that individuals give up their rights to be a member to a greater being. The greater being is the state. That is what fueled the fascism of Italy, the fascism of Germany, and the communism of Russia, that ideal state theory, that collectivism of individuals and giving up their rights to a government. And then once you give up your rights, you don't get them back, right? The state tells you what your rights are. Either the individuals of a country decide what the government can do, or the government decides what rights individuals have. And that is, it is anathema to the concept and foundation of our country. And yet, we have a party in power that is dedicating our country to it and hurtling us into socialism without any regard to the idea that there has never been a successful socialist state in history, in the whole history of human experience. So, you know, I wonder about these PhDs. You're talking about college. And I heard a stat that of the Ivy League tenured professors, 94% of them believe in the Democratic Party, which now believes in socialism. So that,
well, that's not good, because that's very alarming.
I think they forgot John Locke.
My 14-year-old daughter wants to go to law school, and she wants to go to Ivy League law school. But I'm going to have to introduce her myself to different ideas of thinking, so she can have more of an independent thought before she.
Let me send you another book. I'll dedicate it to her.
That would
I'll
be,
sign it for her.
That would be awesome. You know, my daughter. You know, I think you know that I'm a constitutional conservative. You know, my daughter. She's just learning, so she does not know basically where she is right now, you know. And I try to give her information that she can learn from, to have an open mind. You know, I grew up in politics. I don't know how much you know about me, Rich. My father was a civil rights activist in the 60s.
Yeah.
My father was a patriot, conservative. So I grew up under his political tutelage. You know, but and even when you were talking about Alexander Hamill, I remember reading the Federalist Papers when I was in my 20s, you know, and stuff like that. But they are removing American history, American government out of our educational system. And that really is the saddest part. Politicians are getting away with, we're having a tyrannical government. That's what we're leaning towards.
They're trying to remove, they're literally trying to remove our DNA from this country. And I go into it at the end of Shadows of the Acropolis, that the DNA of our country and the DNA being formed by the administrative state, the Democratic Party, the Socialist Party of America, is utterly opposite to the way this country was founded. So how do you do that? You have to remove the DNA from the persons who still believe in the country as it was founded. So you take out its heroes by taking down its statues. You take out its heroes by calling them racists and slavers. You take out the Constitution by saying, wait a minute, it can be changed. Woodrow Wilson, he wrote a lot of books. In his books, he said, look, times change. So can the Constitution. Our founders never looked at it that way. They looked at it as the highest law of the land that would govern the land like the patterns govern the stars, right? Like gravity governs the stars.
Yes.
And so no two stars would run into each other and create an explosion. So that it's utterly – where we're going now is antithetical to the way we were founded. And the reason you're seeing all this movement in the education system, it's all by design, or in the media breaking up the family. It's become very obvious. And so I think if I hope I can get back on, because we're running out of time. But the reason I wrote these two books is because if independence, persons who look at themselves as independents, I'm like you. I'm a conservative constitutionalist. Persons who look at themselves as independents, if they knew this history and where we are today, they would run for another party than the Democratic Party. If Democrats read these books rather than just following the party line every election, if persons who were conservative Democrats, there are still some out there, I think 10% of the party probably, they would run out of the Democratic Party because it's very well explained here. It makes obvious what's going on, and it makes obvious where we're headed, and it's not a good place.
We're headed towards a civil war if we continue to go, and I know that sounds alarming. You're not going to take people's guns away in this country, middle America. That will never happen.
Right.
You can posture it.
Right.
You can posture that you're going to take them, but they will not give up their guns, and they should not, you know. And it's sad. You're right. We're going, you know, the state wants to be your daddy. The state wants to be in control of your family. The state wants to dictate
right.
your health, what you eat, everything. And
what
I
business
am
you
against
can be
the state.
In. What business
I'm
you
sorry?
Can be in. What faith they're trying to determine
right.
now by all this, you know, and I for my part, what gay people do is up to them. It doesn't matter to me.
Would anybody,
but they're trying to
exactly.
they're trying to overturn the freedom of faith we enjoy by saying if your faith does not accept certain things that we demand you accept, it can't exist. Right? That's where they're headed.
Mm-hmm.
And they're trying to do it with a can opener. And that's not going to work in middle America either. So I've been on this mission now, Chauncey, to help people through story form and just the basics to let people know how we grew up to being what we were and why, and then how we've departed from that for the last 100 years and why. And it's all about power, the concentration of power in one place and then selling that power through lobbyists and their interests. And it's the Biden family, it's the Biden family writ large is what it is. You know, laws are now made between agency heads, lobbyists, and that's it, and interested lawyers. And that's who's making the rules now, not our representatives.
You're absolutely correct, and that was one of the things that Donald Trump did when he first got into office to put a 5-year lobbying ban. That really ticked off the right and the left on the establishment, because that's where they're getting their kickback money from, you know.
But corruption. Chauncey, I think they're not persecuting Trump because of his personality. They're persecuting him every single day because of his policies. They scare him to death.
Yes, of course, because it exposes their corruption. It exposes their corruption, their theft, you know, their immorality.
Yep.
You know, listen, you know, Trump has no filter. And the American people are tired of politicians placating to people. That's why we like Donald Trump, because he has no filter. He says it whether we agree or not. He says it how he is. He's not trying to placate to the media, to the people, you know. And I think that is not a politician, you know. I've never heard him called a racist until he ran for president, and I've known of Donald Trump for the past 40 years, you know.
Yeah, exactly so. They use the usual methods of smearing and defaming, and then mm-hmm. cook up a 3 years long investigation in order to rip his life apart while he's president on something that they invented against him. The Russian collusion hoax was, and then they impeached him. And now they're persecuting him again every chance they get. And the reason is not that they dislike him. They dislike his policies, and they cannot stomach them. Because we're at what I call, Chauncey, a Y in the road. We're at a Y in the road. There's the administrative state and the Democratic Party, and there's constitutionalism. And those two are irreconcilable now. One is socialist, and the other, one is socialist based on ideal state theory, and one is based on John Locke and freedom. And there's no combining them anymore. They've been combined now for 100 years. They cannot reconcile anymore. So that's why we're finding all these explosions, like 200 cities being burned down and looted, and all the corruption that went on with the vote when six toss-up states go around their state constitutions, around the federal constitution, and create changes in election law that allowed mail-in voting. And then, you know, waiting a week after election day to say, oh, sorry, you lost.
And it's a lot of crap. And this corruption didn't just start, ladies and gentlemen. I've been in politics all of my life. I've witnessed corruption at an early age. So, you know, they're trying to say, like, there was no corruption. No, there is corruption just about in every election. And, you know, I've always been a conservative, but I lived in Democrat cities, and I participated. I know how they do it. They've altered the machines. I mean, you know, it's sad that people cannot wrap their head around that the election was stolen. I mean, really, a person stays in the basement. If you ever seen any of the rallies, I don't think he had 20 or 30 people. You know, it's just really
hopefully
sad.
The safeguards they're putting in safeguards for the next one, I hope. That won't allow mail-in voting,
Rich, you know,
voting a week after the election, bringing in ballots a week late. Anyway, that's a whole other subject. But here's the problem. Constitutionalists or conservatives like us are all individuals.
Right.
These guys are collectivized, and they have a strategy about everything, about how to get laws passed through agencies, about how to strike down laws arrived at by actual representatives, about how to influence education, how to influence the media. It's a dirty bargain they're in. The remedy is, I think, you know, if I'm asked, it's education. It always was, but we have to get together ourselves. And there's a great website now called AmericanEndeavorInc.com. That's AmericanEndeavorInc.com, run by a man named Rick Stannard. And on that website are all the different organizations that are conservative. This has never been done before. It's a common database dedicated to all the conservative entities in America being able to find each other, being able to communicate. And it's a great service he's doing. And I hope you'll put that on your website, Chauncey.
Mm-hmm.
It's called AmericanEndeavorInc.com.
Yes. Rich, thank you so much. I'm sorry we're out of time, like 2 minutes left. I want to have you back on. We need to be educated on where we are, where we're going, and how we're going to get there.
Well, we'll pick it up where we left off. We'll pick it up back at FDR. But get a hold of Sonia, and she'll work on a calendar. In the meantime, if your audience is interested in the books, they're available at Amazon. You can look up my name, Richard C. Lyons, or the titles, The DNA of Democracy or Shadows of the Acropolis. Or go to my website, richardclyons.com. It's available there. You can ask at Barnes & Noble or any retailer.
Thank you so much, Rich. And for my listeners, I will update the description where those links will be on the description under either Rich's name, his website, or his books. I will tie them into Amazon or wherever his books are located, and I'll have those links where the people can purchase them right away. Thank you so much, Rich, for a ton of information.
Thank you, Chauncey.
Thank you for
asking me on.
And it's a pleasure to have you on. We're going to have you back on soon. I'm going to contact Sonia.
Okay.
And I'm looking forward to us doing a series. All right. Take care, Rich.
Okay,
thank
great.
You very much. Have a great weekend.
All right. Thank you, Chauncey.
Thanks.
Have a great night. Bye-bye.
You too. Take care. We were honored and blessed to have in the studio Richard Lyons, author of The DNA of Democracy and Shadows of the Acropolis. Oh, that's a tongue twister for me. He broke down how our history of democracy came into being and where we are today. And he clearly stated that where we are today, we're in trouble. So we must educate everyone. You know, to know nothing of the past is to understand little of the present and have no conception of the future. The time is at hand, ladies and gentlemen. If you know and respect and want your freedom and liberty, the time is now. We all have to stand up and push back against the tyranny that is transpiring in our country today. I thank you guys for tuning in. Please join me every Tuesday and Thursday, 6 to 7 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. Please follow us to Chomsky on all social media outlets, Facebook, Twitter. We thank all of our supporters. God bless you all, and have a great weekend. We'll see you next week. Good night now.
Lucky Land Casino, asking people, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
Lucky? In line at the deli, I guess?
Aha, in my dentist's office. More than once, actually.
Do I have to say?
Yes, you do.
In the car, before my kid's PTA meeting.
Really?
Yes.
Excuse me, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
I never win and tell.
Well, there you have it. You can get lucky anywhere, playing at LuckyLandSlots.com. Play for free right now. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.